Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday. It's July 29th. 61 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City, and Heber City reporting 60 degrees. On the phone with us now, we have the new meteorologist for ABC4, Cedric Hayes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Great to be with you this morning and to be with all of us out there listening as we talk about your forecast here in Park City. In Heber, we're looking at some hazy sunshine. We've got some of the smoke coming in from those wildfires off towards the west across portions of California, that big fire out towards the west, and that's going to be streaming in with the southwesterly breeze this afternoon. So, yes, it will be sunny, but we're also going to be seeing some of that smoke and haze, and that's going to lower some of the air quality there. So it is in that unhealthy range for sensitive groups. So if you suffer from asthma or other respiratory issues, just kind of keep that in mind. Take it easy out there if you're going to be out throughout the day. The other story, of course, is that sunshine and temperatures will be right around normal for this time of the year. We're looking at highs climbing into the mid-80s up towards the low 90s there as you get closer towards the Heber area. So temperatures right where they should be this time of the year. And then as we go into tonight, we're looking at temperatures in the 40s and 50s again. Now, it will stay dry with all that sunshine out there, so no precipitation is expected, and a nice, comfortable overnight period as we go into your Tuesday. More of the same, mid-80s around Park City, highs around 90 in Heber, and we're looking at that hazy sunshine expected across the area. We are tracking more significant changes, though, as we go throughout the week, because we're going to have a little dip in the jet stream that's going to be with us this week here that's giving us these mid-90s as we go into the next, let's say, the middle of the work week. But then we've got a big heat dome that's going to build back in. It's the heat dome that was with us last week. It's off to our south this week here to start. But as we go into the middle and latter half of the week, that heat dome is going to build back in. That's going to bring back highs. Yes, even into portions of like the Heber area, we're looking at highs in the upper 90s, close to 100. Park City will see those highs even back into the 90s as well as we get towards the weekend. So lots of sunshine, a fairly dry week ahead, but we're also going to be looking at some very warm temperatures that are going to be returning to the area. So make sure that you're keeping that in mind as you make your weekend plans. If you're going to be planning on recreating outside during the weekend, the heat will be the big story, along with some of that hazy sunshine there. And because of the dry conditions, we do have that critical fire danger alert, which just basically means, hey, that any sparks that do get going could spread easily in these type of conditions. So again, just be careful if you're going to be out and about, especially if you're going to be dealing within any flames or any type of activity that could produce any flames across parts of the area. But precipitation or rain chances looking slim to none as we go throughout this week. There is a slight chance we could see a little moisture moving into places as we get towards, let's say, Sunday into Monday of next week as we try to get a little monsoon moisture coming in. But between now and then, it's looking fairly dry with temperatures on a warming trend. And that's the way the forecast is looking as we go throughout this week.
All right. So before I let you go, congratulations on the new job.
Thank you.
You're obviously a morning person, but tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, where do you come from?
Yes. So I come from Chattanooga, Tennessee. So I'm kind of a Southern guy, and I'm just excited to be out here in the state of Utah. You know, I love all of the extreme weather that we get to track out here, from snow to cold to heat waves to wildfires. It's all, you can all get it in the state, the same state, sometimes on the same day. So that's always great. But weather's been a passion of mine since I was 7 years old. So just excited to continue to live that dream and to get the forecast for all the folks out there.
All right. Well, welcome to Utah. Glad to have you along. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Leslie. Great to be with you.
It's 8:10. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be talking with the editor of Lift Blog, Peter Landsman. He has visited all of North America's chairlifts. Peace House Executive Director Kendra Wyckoff will be in with an update on some of their programs there. And Park City Senior Center President Liz Novak with an update on what's happening there at our local senior centers. In some local news now, a Colville area fire that sparked on Pioneer Day is now 100% contained. KPCW's Grace Storfler has this update.
Fire officials report the 361-acre Dicker Hill fire is entirely contained as of 6 p.m. Sunday. Containment describes how much of the fire's perimeter is secure, not how much land is still burning. Mike Erickson from the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands says the fire will be managed entirely by local crews going forward, and now firefighters will mostly be monitoring the site.
It'll probably just be an engine coming up here maybe once or twice a day. They might come out in the afternoon, get up on one of those ridge stops, and look at some of the areas where we had some concerns and make sure there's no smoke.
He says rain over the weekend helped crews get the blaze under control. That enabled firefighters to decrease the fire's severity classification. 4 helicopters, 2 hand crews, 3 bulldozers, and 10 engines were called in when the fire was reported just after 4 p.m. July 24th. Erickson says most of those resources are no longer needed. Firefighters from the Salt Lake area and a statewide task force helped significantly increase containment over the weekend. By the end of the weekend, they were able to turn the fire over to local crews for monitoring. Erickson urges residents to be cautious as the hot, dry summer continues.
In the next 2 or 3 months, the long-term forecast is supposed to be staying hot and dry through August, September, and October, which means we might have like this extended fall fire season. And the less human-caused ones, the happier our firefighters are going to be.
Details have not yet been released about how the human-caused fire began. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
For more than 20 years, the founder and editor of LiftBlog, a website dedicated to covering the world of ski lifts, tramways, and gondolas, Peter Landsman has spent his free time visiting all of the chairlifts in North America. He recently completed his quest. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Leslie.
Yeah, so what's your fascination with chairlifts?
You know, that's a good question. I've been interested in them really as long as I've been skiing, which is since I was about 3 years old. Ski lifts, every single one is unique, so they're specifically designed for a specific place on a specific mountain, and I just really enjoy checking out as many as I can and seeing the differences between them.
So take us back a bit. I mean, at what point did you decide, I'm going to visit every chairlift possible in North America?
Well, that was really more recent. I didn't really think that was possible until I got quite a ways through this journey. I grew up skiing in the Pacific Northwest. I'm from Seattle originally. So initially it was just trying to ride all the lifts at my home ski area, which was Snoqualmie Pass. There are about 30 chairlifts there. And initially I just wanted to ride all of those. And then as soon as I was old enough to drive, I would go to the different ski areas in Washington and the Pacific Northwest. And then I went to college in New England. So I got to explore some of the ski areas in Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont. And then after that, I moved to where I live now in Jackson, Wyoming, and started exploring the lifts of the Mountain West.
So, is it that you just visit them, or you're actually, you've ridden them all as well?
Most of them. There are a few lifts that sometimes don't operate very often. Like, for example, on Park City Mountain, some of the listeners may know about Eaglet, which is a little chairlift used for the Olympics in 2002 that very rarely operates. So occasionally there's a lift that I just have to kind of ski under or hike up to visit and count that as riding because it doesn't operate very often.
Hmm. So how many chairlifts are there in North America?
Right now, 2,956.
Okay. And do you visit other than the chairlifts? I mean, we're talking also about gondolas as well?
Yeah, so gondolas, aerial tramways like you see at Snowbird or here in Jackson Hole. And then a lot of ski areas just have surface lifts, so like a T-bar tow or a platter lift. The smaller ski areas in particular don't even have chairlifts.
Hmm. And are there other lifts besides at ski resorts that you visited? I can't give any
examples. There
example. Are. Yeah.
So Lagoon there in Utah, the water park and amusement park has a chairlift. It just goes completely flat across the park. Increasingly, gondolas are being used for public transportation. So like in Portland, Oregon, there's an aerial tram that goes from a kind of a waterfront neighborhood up to a hospital, and that's used for public transit. So there are a lot of different uses for chairlifts and gondolas other than just skiing.
Yeah, so you visited those as well. Is that included in that 2956 number?
It is, yeah. So I've been to quite a few zoos and state fairs and amusement parks that have these lifts as well.
So once you would get to a chairlift, I mean, what would you do? Take a photo, write it, or just check a box on your list?
All of the above. So I've been known to be quite the lift photographer. I run this website called Lift Blog that has all the photos of all the lifts I've visited. So I take a lot of pictures of each lift that I visit, and then put the best photos of each one on my website for others to look at.
Yeah, so how long has this taken you? 20 years?
Yeah, about that. It's I'm 34 years old, and I've been at this since I was quite young. And it really accelerated in the last maybe 5 years when I had more free time when I was out of school.
Yeah. Now, have you run into the problem of visiting a chairlift and then having it replaced, so then you'd have to go back? I mean, and the example I'm thinking of is that you probably have visited the Sunrise chairlift that was installed back in the days of Park West there at the base of Canyons Village. Now it's being replaced by a gondola by Vail. So do you add that to your list, or is the fact that you've already seen the Sunrise lift already count?
No, I really don't view that as a problem. I actually like going back to see the new lifts. So I will go back when that new Sunrise gondola opens. Utah is really an exciting place right now because there's so many lift construction projects underway, not just Park City, but Deer Valley has expanded excellence going on. There's a new lift going in this summer at Snowbird. And so Utah will keep me busy, and then I'll look forward to visiting all the new lifts all over the country this coming winter.
Wow. Okay. So you're going to hold off on coming to the Deer Valley area till those 14 lifts have been installed in a few years?
There are so many new lifts going in at Deer Valley. I'll probably be going there every year for the next few years. It's quite the happening place for the lift construction business.
Yeah. So it sounds like, I guess, the tour never ends. I mean, there's always new chairlifts being installed, huh?
Exactly. And there are also new ski areas occasionally open. And then sometimes ski areas close. So it's kind of a never-ending cycle of lifts that are coming and going from the active fleet across the ski industry.
Yeah. So what was the route you took? I mean, would it look more like a scribble across the North American continent, or would we see kind of back-and-forth lines?
A lot of back and forth. So I live in Jackson Hole. I actually work at Jackson Hole Mountain Resort as a lift supervisor here. So I only have a few days off from work at a time. So I would typically plan a trip where I would fly or drive somewhere from Jackson, ski for two, maybe 2.5 days, and then have to come back to work. It would have been much faster if I didn't have a job during this whole time. So I kind of split it up based on snow and maybe ticket prices of flights, and really did this journey in a lot of small chunks.
Yeah. So did you find any sponsors along the way?
I have. My website is sponsored by both of the major lift manufacturers. They're both European, but have major operations in the United States. And some other companies that service the ski industry also advertise on my blog. So I've got some revenue to pay for all this travel.
I was going to say. And, I mean, have you taken, like, a real vacation? Like, maybe, I don't know, to a beach or something?
Very rarely. I think I've been to Hawaii once. Most of my last 15 years of my life has been spent either working at a ski area part of the week or visiting a ski area somewhere in the U.S. or Canada. And I do enjoy traveling, so it doesn't feel like hard work, really.
Yeah. So any particular chairlifts or gondolas or anything stand out for you? I mean, I don't know if there's a favorite here, but something that maybe really kind of touched you one way or another?
Well, as I said, they are all unique. Every single lift is designed for a specific place on a specific mountain. One that stands out technologically is called the Peak to Peak Gondola, which is up at Whistler Blackcomb in British Columbia. And it's the only 3S gondola in North America currently. So it's got three different cables, and it goes between two mountains. And the highest point, it's 1,400 feet in the air. So it's a very unique lift, particularly for North America, and probably my personal favorite.
Okay. So recently there was a bit of a celebration for you here at in Salt Lake City. Tell me a little bit about that. That was after you had finished your last chairlift?
Yeah, so my last lift was in June. I went up to the Yukon Territory in Canada. It took three airplanes and a six-hour drive to get there. And then on my way back, I was connecting from my second plane to my third plane in Salt Lake to get back to Jackson Hole, and a whole bunch of the ski industry surprised me in the airport at the gate. So I was totally blown away. Had no idea this was happening, but Ski Utah, Todd Bennett from Deer Valley, Dave Amaralt, who's worked at a bunch of Utah resorts, and the lift companies, just a whole bunch of ski industry people that I'd worked with, surprised me at the gate with some gifts and a cake. So it was pretty fun.
Yeah, so there was a nice cake. Again, the friends you mentioned, and then this given a bell. Tell me about the bell.
So Doppelmayr is one of the lift manufacturers, and they're based in Austria, and they have this tradition where they give their customers who buy a new gondola or a new chairlift a very large cowbell that would be used in Austria to put on a cow so you could hear where it is up in the high alpine and find the cow. In the ski industry context, they give out the bell to their customers who buy a lift just kind of as a symbol of good luck and prosperity. And they were very kind and gave me one for completing my mission to visit all the lifts.
Yeah, quite the quest there. So what have you done with the bell?
Well, again, it's a very large bell. So I have a very small apartment in Jackson Hole, and I need to do some structural analysis on my walls to see if I can hang it without damaging my building. So I haven't done too much with it yet, but it's going to last a long time. This bell is quite stout, so I'll find a good place for it soon enough.
Okay. And as I mentioned, I mean, you kind of write for a living on the side there. So any plans to kind of write a book about your expedition here?
Well, that's correct. I do some freelance writing for Ski Area Management magazine and some other ski magazines. So I do have some experience writing, and I have a whole lot of pictures of these mountains that I've been to, 750 mountains. So a book would be a good idea. If I ever stop running around to ski resorts and new lifts, I should sit down and write a book.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to tell us about your expedition here?
Just that you guys are in Utah and Park City are very lucky. The number of new lifts being built in Utah and the quality of skiing you have there is awesome. So I always look forward to getting down to Utah to ski.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking New York, I believe, and Michigan have the highest number of ski resorts. So is that where you found most of the chairlifts?
Correct. And Pennsylvania has a lot, too. What I realized doing this quest is that the number of ski resorts, when you have a lot of ski resorts, they tend to be smaller. So Colorado and Utah, places like that, have much bigger ski resorts, but typically not as many. So there's a lot of skiing at small ski resorts that people don't even realize. You know, you think of the Vails and Snowbird and Park City, but there are hundreds and hundreds of really small ski areas in places like New York and Wisconsin that really are where people learn to ski.
Yeah. All right, Peter. Well, thanks for sharing your travels here. That was pretty interesting. Congratulations for finishing.
Thank you, Leslie.
That's Peter Landsmith. Again, he is the founder and editor of Lift Blog, and again, just has toured 2,956 chairlifts across North America. In the studio now with an update from Peace House, I have Executive Director Kendra Wyckoff. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Maybe just first start by telling listeners what Peace House is and what it is that you do.
Right. Thanks so much. We are a nonprofit organization located here in Park City, but serving both Summit and Wasatch counties. And our mission is related to ending interpersonal violence and abuse. So we serve victims of domestic violence and sexual assault with a number of different services, including safe housing, support services, and we also provide prevention education support in our communities.
All right. And you've been a nonprofit for almost 30 years now.
Yes. Yeah. 2025 will be our 30th anniversary, which just seems unbelievable. But we have been supported for a long time by this community. Thankfully, we have critical life-saving services, and it will be exciting to celebrate with our community on that anniversary.
So any plans at this point in terms of that celebration?
We're working on plans. So we do not have anything solidified, but we want our community to know that we really appreciate their support and that more information will be coming.
And what's kind of been interesting, I think, watching you from just, you know, the small shelter that you had here in Park City, moving out to your new campus there at Quinn's Junction, is I kind of had hope with more education we would see less of the problem, but you're not seeing those numbers, are you?
No, we're actually seeing significant increases, and I think that it's multifaceted. I mean, our communities continue to grow, so of course when your population grows, you have more people, and you're going to have, you know, more issues related to domestic violence and sexual assault. Accessibility, so when we were in the small emergency shelter and we had a small outreach office, you know, we were kind of hidden in the community and might not have been as easy to find. And so now with our community campus being publicly disclosed, a few doors down from the hospital, the fact that we've been able to do more outreach work and let people know that we're available and we're available 24/7, I think we're seeing that impact where individuals are now aware, oh, there are resources and services and support available, so they're reaching out for help. Or they're referring other people to help.
Yeah. And is it because of these resources that women might have the wherewithal then to say enough is enough and be able to walk away?
Yeah, I think it's, again, you know, domestic violence is really complicated. And victims of domestic violence have a number of reasons why they stay in relationships that may be abusive. An abuser has an incredible amount of control in the relationship, and oftentimes victims are facing a number of different types of abuses, everything from emotional, verbal, financial, to physical and sexual abuse. So it can be very dangerous to leave. Actually, we know, statistically speaking, that's the most dangerous time for a victim of domestic violence is when they leave the relationship, and why we are always talking to our community about when somebody is starting that process to reach out for support, because we want to help increase their safety and support while they go through that process. There are also a number of other reasons. You know, people are very hopeful. There are cultural and religious reasons why they may stay in a relationship. But I do think at the heart of it, when you know that there are resources available, when you know that you're not alone and that there is support for you, it is something that can give people hope and give them the opportunity to increase their safety and to heal from the trauma and abuse.
All right. Well, you are funded with what, many state and federal grants?
We are. You know, we're about 45% funded by federal and state grants. And then about 55% of our funding comes from fundraising events and our private donors and community foundations, businesses, corporations that have been, you know, longstanding supporters of our 24/7 services.
Yeah. Back in June, you hosted the Healing Hearts Hoedown. So that was a fundraiser?
It was. It was our inaugural event. It was held out at the 4U Ranch in Peoa. I don't know if I'd call it a gala. It was a little more informal, but Western themed. And it was really a wonderful opportunity to bring together supporters of Peace House, to introduce folks to Peace House around our mission and to inspire them to support the mission. So it was incredibly successful. We had a wonderful time. We had dancing and, of course, small plates and cocktails. We had mini Norwegian cows and fly fishing and roping demonstrations. And it just really was a beautiful event where folks came together really to rally around our mission and to rally around survivors in our community. And we're so grateful. And I just want to say thank you so much. We had wonderful sponsors, Vail Epic Promise sponsored the event, the Marriott Daughters Foundation, and a very, very special thank you to Gary and Donna Urban. They own the 4U Ranch out there in Piola, and they were just so gracious in supporting us and allowing us to have that event out there and supporting our efforts. We had a wonderful committee, and of course, our staff did a fantastic job. So we're just really grateful that this community comes together and really shows that they care about the most vulnerable people and are willing to provide that support so that we can ensure that services are available around the clock.
All right. So the funds that you may have raised during that just would go into your general fund?
Yes, yeah. They would. And, you know, as you're probably aware, you know, there are oftentimes gaps across all our programs. We have 8 programs. And so those funds really help us fill those gaps in.
Okay. Talk a little bit about how you hope to expand some of those programs.
Right. So there's a couple of things that we're seeing. And we, with the implementation of the lethality assessment protocol that happened in July of last year, which is a lethality assessment that is utilized by law enforcement when they're on scene with domestic violence victims. And what that does is basically it's an evidence-based questionnaire that helps law enforcement assess the lethality or the dangerousness of a situation. And the protocol is when somebody screens in high danger, they call our helpline. So we're seeing a tremendous increase. We've seen about 100% increase in law enforcement referrals to Peace House. And that has a ripple effect across all our programs where we've seen a 41% increase in engagement and requests for services across everything from emergency shelter to transitional housing, to counseling, to legal advocacy and case management. And, you know, really at the end of the day, this year, we're kind of looking at what are some of those impacts? And we need to expand some capacity. We need additional support with legal advocacy. We have one legal advocate. She's amazing. She's been with Peace House for 20 years. But when you see these significant increases, we need more staff support. And one of the things that we have been seeing trend over the course of the last couple of years, and of course was part of the vision of the campus, was really specializing around children's services. And this year, I can tell you, we've seen a 50% increase in the number of kids living on our campus this fiscal year. And, you know, I'm not sure what the dynamics are. I certainly think that those referrals from our law enforcement partners are impacting families coming into emergency shelter. But one of the things that we recognize between those two safe housing programs on our campus is that kids need some specialized support and services. We have a space in our center. We have outfitted that space to be able to support the needs of babies up to the age of 10, 12 years old. We hired a director of children's services this spring, and she has developed a 3-year plan to scale out children's services. This summer, we started with some family activities on Saturdays to really bring families together and build trust with those families. And we're starting some respite care in that center in August so that individuals who are living on our campus, those adult survivors, are going to have a little additional support where kiddos will be able to go to that space and be supported by individuals who have the training, have the knowledge to support them, little ones that have been affected by domestic violence, and have the opportunity to maybe, for the adult survivor, to take a breather while those little kids get the support that they need. We also will be hiring a child advocate so they can specialize in the child advocacy piece and really be doing safety planning with those little people and ensuring that little people and their needs are being met alongside the adult survivors.
Hmm. So do you have room for all of that?
Well, we fortunately planned for the children's services piece, and we have that children's center. And that's right there in the middle of the facility, and we've just been working to outfit it. We had some wonderful volunteers, Laura Arnold and Mayor Piper, who did a fantastic job of decorating it so it looks kid-friendly. You know, we definitely are filling our office spaces, but just like every other organization, we're creative. You know, we share office space, and we're here to meet the needs of the community.
Yeah. So this law, that requires police officers to conduct these lethality assessments, I guess that's good news, bad news for you. I mean, that we're really kind of spending some time with kind of instead of a he said, she said.
Yeah. You know, the state of Utah has been working on, you know, being more progressive when it comes to domestic violence calls and investigations for many, many years. You know, we do definitely have laws that are not necessarily he said, she said anymore. You know, it's really based on probable cause and evidence when police respond. The LAP, the lethality assessment, what that really does is it's an evidence-based tool that's been researched for about 30 years. Dr. Jacqueline Campbell, who is a nurse with a PhD, so she's a doctor, who really spent a lot of time around researching intimate partner femicide and attempted femicide. And what she found is that there were a number of factors that she could see where victims of domestic violence were being killed by their partners about within 12 months of having law enforcement involved. And one of the things that she would see is, for example, a partner threatening to kill their partner or a partner threatening to kill themselves. There were other factors like if the abusive partner was unemployed or if strangulation or choking had occurred. And what she found in those cases is that the majority of the victims that had been murdered had not been connected with victim services. So it's got a two-fold, you know, two-prong approach. One is identify those at highest risk by asking these questions and then calling the 24/7 community-based advocacy program and ensuring that a victim has an opportunity to talk to a trained advocate about what resources are available, to safety plan, and to access emergency shelter if that's what they want to do. We at Peace House have our own protocol where we can continue with permission to follow up with that victim and offer services, because sometimes when you're in the heat of this crisis, you're not ready to come into shelter. And we see people come back and engage in services 2-3 months later. What that is doing is really being intentional about ensuring that those with the highest risk get connected to support in our communities.
Yeah, so that's really interesting, right? Because you were seeing, I mean, when you say 40-some percent, you know, of people, yes, kind of increase in that, those people were previously then kind of slipping through the cracks.
Some of them were. And I do want to mention this because, you know, our county also has been really progressive. We had been partnering with Summit County Sheriff's Office and with Park City PD already on the LAP before it was made mandatory by the legislature. But it added on, you know, some other partners. We were partnering with Heber City as well. So Wasatch County came on, and then the Camas Police Department. But it, as a whole, you know, we're seeing that that instrument is being utilized across these two service areas, and more people are getting referred to us. And that's the good news, right? And now we're just working to try to keep up with those needs.
Yeah. All right. Well, talk a little bit about how people can help. I mean, I know you're always looking for donations, not just financial.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, we are a nonprofit organization, and we rely on the community support in a number of different ways. So financial donations are wonderful, but in-kind support, you know, just imagine when you have 50 to 60 people living on the campus, our home needs just about everything that you need at your house. Times 100. So garbage bags, you know, children's snacks. The way to find that information is to go to our website at peacehouse.org, go to our wish list. You'll see that we have urgent needs, everything again from children's snacks to food to gift cards to help our families maybe get some things that we don't have on campus. Some other ways to help out, volunteerism. So we have a great volunteer coordinator. Her name's Madison. We're putting on 2 volunteer trainings a year now, which help our agency, you know, again, leverage those human resources. And we have volunteers that help out our front desk. We have volunteers that respond with our hospital response team on sexual assault calls. So lots of opportunities to get involved with Peace House and to support survivors in our community.
Okay. And then also wanted to mention that you've got another event coming up in October. Tell us about that quickly.
Yes, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and so we really use that month to highlight awareness around this issue. Of course, we're doing that all year long, but this has been nationally recognized. Purple is the color for domestic violence awareness, so you often see that color up and about ribbons. We will be having a number of different educational pieces throughout that month, and of course, a social media campaign, but we will be holding a walk in Heber City, and this is the first year that we'll be doing a walk in Heber City at the park there, and partnering with both our Summit County and Wasatch County community partners to host awareness around this issue and to really generate resources, not just with Peace House, but with some of the other resources that we partner with to support survivors.
Okay, Kendra, anything else you want to mention?
I would just say, it's really important for our community to know we're available 24/7. Please reach out. The 1-800 number, which is 1-800-647-9 9161. That number is available to anyone. Whether you're experiencing abuse, you know somebody who's experiencing abuse, you don't have to be an expert in these issues. Let our team help support you. And if you need to help support someone else, we can do that as well. So please reach out to us. You can also come to our community campus. I think that's one of the most beautiful things that I've seen about our campus is just the increased accessibility. I'm so grateful that we have that space where we're at and we're able to provide the services that we can. We've seen people come at 2 o'clock in the morning. We've seen people show up at 7 a.m. It's important for people to know that we are here for you. Our lights are always on at Peace House.
Okay. Kendra, thanks so much for your time this
morning.
Thanks,
Leslie.
Kendra Wyckoff is the executive director of Peace House. In the studio now with an update from the Park City Senior Center, I have President Liz Novak. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning.
Yeah, so since we last talked, the Park City Senior Center, I think, opened now twice as many days as it was?
Yes, so we're open 4 days a week now. We've gone from 2 days, obviously, Monday and Thursday. Now it's Monday through Thursday, 9 to 4.
Okay. Lunch, however, still only served on Monday, Thursday.
Yes, yes.
All right. So where did you get the funding to keep it open?
Well, it was a number of different resources that we tapped. Summit County in particular stepped up with regards to providing us dedicated staffing Monday through Thursday. So we have 3.5 days of full-time staff, if you will, and then a half a day that's covered by Kelly Jacobs, our activities and program director. So that was a huge shot in the arm, if you will. And also the foundation, Park City Community Foundation, provided support in terms of some resources so that we could offer more programs and activities, as well as Park City Municipal funding the 2-year position of Kelly Jacobs so that we can continue to have a coordinator and a senior advocate on site.
Okay, well, tell us what happens during the day, Monday through Thursday.
Oh, my goodness. Well, what doesn't happen at the Senior Center? Well, as you know, Leslie, we have gone from about 70 members approximately 5 years ago to over 570 today. So it is just, it's a whirlwind, Monday through Thursday. The site that we now occupy is about 3,000 square feet, and our programs range from anything from games and activities, Mon John to bridge. We have exercise classes thanks to Peg Bodell and also the Park City Mark. We also offer art classes thanks to Kimball Arts Center. We have lectures. We're working with the Great Decisions Program through the Summit County Library. I need to take a breath. We have quite a bit of activity. We're working now. We're partnering with Park City Opera. They're offering musical interludes during lunch, if you will, and also lectures about the history of opera. That was most recent. And ballet next. The list just goes on and on and on in terms of programs and activities, not to mention field trips that we take in the community. For example, Kelly Jacobs has coordinated a field trip out to the new treatment plant here in Park City.
All right. So is there a schedule online that people can find out?
Thank you. Yes.
Dates and times?
ParkCitySeniors.org. You can go on our website and check out all the programs and activities. We have an updated calendar, and we also announced the new programs that we're offering as well. I mentioned the Great Decisions Program. We also have a sommelier, if I hope I'm saying that correctly, Sean, who's offering classes, wine classes, on Wednesdays. So it's a very robust activity schedule, and I encourage people to go to our website and really check out the latest.
Okay, so who can participate? I mean, what, 60 and older to register?
60 and older, and that's really the only requirement. There is a membership fee. Now, wait for it. $5 a year to become a member, and you must be a member to participate in the programs and activities. So, but we think that's a pretty good deal, $5 a year.
Yeah. So 3,000 square feet, how many members can you fit in there?
Well, if you talk to the fire marshal here in Park City, we can accommodate 101 people for congregate meals as long as we don't shut the accordion doors that divide the room. So, and it's cheek to jowl. We typically have between 60 and 70 folks in for congregate meals on Mondays and Thursdays. And then the room adjacent to where we serve our meals can accommodate around 50 people. So it's tight. When you consider the number of members we have and the facility that we have to work with, it really creates a challenge.
Yeah. Meals are not free, but pretty reasonable.
Yes. Meals are $3 for 60 and older. However, the caveat to that is if we have a senior that comes in to our senior center and does not have the means to pay for a lunch, they're offered a meal for free.
All right. People do need to sign up in advance.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Leslie, for pointing that out. Yes, we ask that folks call or contact the senior center 5 o'clock the night before we serve our meals, just so we're prepared in this, and Summit County, who provides the meals, is prepared for the number that we need.
Okay, well, what's the latest now with a new center that should be a bigger center?
All right, I need to take a breath. and the reason I'm saying that is because it's an uphill battle. We're working with Park City Municipal, and we appreciate the work of the Woodside 2 Committee. That's what we're calling the committee that's looking at developing and building a new senior center along with some affordable housing for seniors and community members as well. And we appreciate the mayor, Mayor Nan Worrell, and Tana Tolley, our councilwoman, who is serving also on this committee and working very closely with five board members from Park City Senior Citizens Incorporated. The reason we're feeling it's a little bit of an uphill battle, we have lost two key players who have been sitting on that committee, Jason Glidden and Brone, who have left Park City Municipal. So there's a sense of the team is starting over because of the institutional memory that's been lost. However, I think with the Woodside 2 committee members still being in place from the board, and also the mayor and Councilwoman Tolley, we'll pick up the pace again. Our next meeting isn't until August 20th. So we're anxious to put a shovel in the ground, but I think, you know, given all of the projects throughout the city, we recognize that the senior center is just one of many projects. And of course, you know, the age-old question, how do we fund a new senior center? The goal is a 10,000 square foot senior center with an additional 6,000 square feet shared space with the rest of the community that would be housed on that property on Woodside. But it really is becoming, you know, quite an effort. And we believe we have the community support. When you look at the numbers, 20% of the seniors living in Park City and Summit County are seniors. 70% of that population lives basically in the Snyderville Basin and Park City 060. So when you look at who's tapping the resources at this particular center here on Woodside, 70% of it is coming from those two areas.
Yeah. So you started to say, how does that get paid for? Mm-hmm. I know the city has set aside money. Do they continue to do that every year?
Currently, there's $3.5 million that have been set aside. But that funding source is also to cover temporary housing, because once the current senior center is raised, then we need to be housed somewhere. Well, part of that housing piece, if you will, in terms of having the resources to do that, will come out of that $3.5 million. That is clearly not enough. So, you know, we're looking to the city to support the center, and they have, you know, given us a nod. I believe they do support us in terms of a new center, but we're also tapping Summit County and, you know, asking, what is your role to support a senior center that has, you know, at least half of the people living in Summit County using the Park City facilities? So it's that three-legged stool: Park City Senior Citizens, Park City Municipal, and Summit County, all working together to fund a new senior center that is needed. When you look at the pipeline, when you look at folks who are 50 to 60 years old, well, 15% are sitting in that pipeline. So we're not going away. Yeah. I mean, the objective is we're all going to become seniors.
Right. We hope. Yeah.
Yeah, we that's the plan.
Have you identified a temporary building?
We have not. There's been conjecture about, well, gee, could we be housed in the Skull Candy building that Summit County has purchased, because there has been, some motion towards housing some services at the Skull Candy building. Treasure Mountain Junior High, what's going on with that building before it's raised? But again, these are just conversations. There has been nothing buttoned down with regards to where we're going to be housed. That's the question.
Yeah, is there a timeline on the construction? You're not even that close.
We're not that close. Realistically, we were hoping to get a shovel in the ground by fall, but are we looking at August? Yes, I think we are. So that clearly isn't going to happen. So if we can look at next spring, I think that's ambitious, but we're cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, well, I haven't even seen the plans come through Planning Commission, though.
No,
yeah,
they have not. We're still in the committee stage in working with developers who are interested in that property.
All right. So what else do you have going on?
Well, let's see. What else do we have? Well, we're looking at, we're still reaching out and applying for grants. For example, Summit County has just opened up the window for nonprofits to apply for nonprofit grants. So we are looking at applying for that grant. And the focus with that particular grant is funding a grant writer. We think that if we could have a grant writer working with Park City Senior Citizens Incorporated, we might be able to find some additional resources that would support our aspirations with regards to a new senior center, because there's capital outlay needs, there's personnel needs. It would be wonderful if we could have a dedicated executive director. Right now, the board operates, their volunteers, they operate as an executive director in terms of the operation of the senior center. So looking at dedicated staff, but where are the resources to pay for dedicated full-time staff at the senior center is the question. So we're researching grants, and I think applying for a grant that would fund a grant writer would open up quite a few avenues for us in terms of, you know, garnering additional resources.
Okay. And then when do you hope to have another day of lunches?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you, Leslie, for bringing that up. We have asked the county, because this is a program through Summit County, we have asked the county with support from Mountainlands government to fund an additional day. We're looking at perhaps next year in 2025. As far as the rest of 2024, that is not going to happen. But I think it'll come to fruition in 2025. So that's one of our asks. When the county is looking at their budget, they're going through the process as of August. So one of our asks of the county is that they fund an additional day.
Okay, well, good luck with that. Anything
Thank
else you.
You
wanted to mention?
No, I just appreciate the opportunity, Leslie, for us to come forward and share all the good news that's happening and let the community know that these seniors are not invisible. We are alive and well, and we would like to just continue to solicit support for a new senior center and additional staffing.
Okay.
So
Liz,
thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
Liz,
have a good day.
Liz Novak, again, is the president of the Park City Senior Center. Taking a look at some local news now, Park City mountain biker Haley Batten cycled her way to an Olympic silver medal yesterday. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more on that.
Batten's silver medal in cross-country cycling made U.S. history. It's the best ever finish by an American in Olympic mountain biking. She battled past a broken wheel mid-race to secure second place, just under 3 minutes behind the gold medalist from France. 25-year-old Batten is at the Olympic Games for the second time this summer. She also raced in Tokyo, where she finished ninth. Her silver medal is just the third Olympic medal won by an American in the history of women's mountain biking. The Salt Lake Tribune reports Batten is among nearly 40 athletes with close ties to Utah at the Summer Games. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
And a fire that started in Browns Canyon near the border of Summit and Wasatch counties yesterday afternoon grew to about 10 acres before crews were able to stop its spread. Summit County Sheriff Sergeant Skyler Talbot told KPCW that South Summit and Park City Fire District crews responded to the scene at about 3 o'clock yesterday. She says about a mile of Browns Canyon Road near State Route 248 had to be shut down so firefighters could assess the situation. Just after 4:30, Utah Fire and info reported that firefighters had stopped the blaze from spreading farther and structures were no longer being threatened. The cause of the fire does remain under investigation.